Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. National Prescription Drug Take-Back Day is Saturday. The Drug Enforcement Administration started the program 8 years ago to give people a safe place to dispose of unused or expired prescription drugs. More than 5,400 locations are participating across the country. Joining us now by phone is Regional Director of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Douglas O'Brien. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Great to be here today.
Why was this started 8 years ago?
I think across the country, there was a realization that medication that went unused in people's homes presented a risk and a danger. We've seen over the last several years, as the opioid epidemic has exploded all around the country, that those prescription medications, prescription pain medications, have really served as a gateway for about 80% of those who ended up in heroin use and heroin addiction. So it's critically important for families to take that step to ensure that they're not inadvertently contributing to the supply that's fueling the opioid epidemic.
You mean pain medications sitting in medicine cabinets are responsible, the unused or not supposed to be being used, are responsible for 80% of the addiction? I mean, or you mean like somebody who's not supposed to be taking them is getting into them?
Exactly. That's called the diversion. And what happens is other family members who either misuse those leftover medications and can become addicted. Opioid pain medications are highly addictive, and it does not take a very, very significant supply for somebody to develop a dependency and an addiction. So somebody misusing a family member's leftover pain medication, let's say from a sports injury or from a surgery, can become addicted to that medication. And what we've seen and what the data shows us is that for many people who are now currently abusing heroin and other illicit drugs, they started by misusing prescription opioids.
This is a twice-yearly event, right?
Well, it is a twice-yearly event, roughly coinciding with clocks moving forward and clocks moving back. But our objective at HHS is that every day needs to be take-back day. Take-back day is another example of how we've got an integrated approach working with state, local, and community partners around the country. Promoting take-back day at the local level is something that we're seeing more and more is a 365-day-a-year effort. Police stations, fire stations, retail pharmacies who are providing a safe and effective way to dispose of medications that people no longer use and shouldn't have in their homes. And I might add, this doesn't just include those pain medications mm-hmm. that really present the biggest danger, but really any medications that you don't need, and certainly those that are expired, you need to dispose of and dispose of safely.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about what to do with drugs that are expired or no longer needed. My guest is Douglas O'Brien. He's Regional Director of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services with the Drug Enforcement Administration. Made Saturday the next big National Prescription Drug Take-Back Day. But as Douglas O'Brien just said, you can bring them back anytime you want if you find the right place. And we're going to put a link on our website to show people where they can, you know, where those locations are right now. If you have a question or comment for Doug O'Brien, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what are these agencies that are receiving them, police, fire, pharmacies, that kind of a thing, what are they doing with the drugs?
There are pretty set protocols for how to responsibly dispose of expired or unneeded medications. Generally, they're incinerated because a lot of people know you don't want to be disposing, you don't want to put them down the sink, you don't want to put them, you don't want to flush them because we don't need those chemicals to be getting into our public water system. You certainly don't want to just throw them in a trash can. And so when they're collected, they are disposed of with pretty distinct finality, because we really want to make sure that that American families and Americans aren't inadvertently adding to the supply of illicit drugs that are out there.
What is the problem with just flushing them down the toilet? What you're saying, it's the water system. They don't treat for that, I guess.
Different. You know, I'm not an expert on municipal water systems, but I know that it is a concern of various professionals about putting those substances into the water system and how well they can be removed. So it is just judged the best bet to dispose of them properly through the regulations that we have for law enforcement agencies, first response agencies, and retail pharmacies and other organizations. So they're securely disposed of, and that they are disposed of once and for all, and they no longer represent any risk or threat to the public.
Have the guidelines for disposing of prescription drugs changed over time?
I think that we've become more and more conscientious about the risk that any sort of medication can pose if it's lying around, if it's sitting in a medicine cabinet, if it's sitting in somebody's home, and understanding that the best and most responsible way to get rid of those is through the policies and procedures we have that the DEA has really put together for disposal.
One of the guidelines says that if disposing of them in the household trash, it says to mix them up with something like dirt or cat litter, but not to crush them. Why not crush them? What difference does it make?
Well, I think that I think that you want to just basically make them unusable, but you don't want them to be in a situation where you're putting them in any place where they can become a problem, you know, whether it's in a landfill or in a water system. You want to ensure that they're disposed of effectively.
Mm-hmm.
Those guidelines are put together to ensure that we're minimizing the risk to the public. And really, again, as I emphasize, the easiest thing to do is to take them, you know, to one of your local repositories, whether it's a retail pharmacy or a police or fire station, and then you know beyond a shadow of a doubt that they're going to be disposed of thoroughly and completely and once and for all.
Some people don't want to drop out the drugs because they don't want people to know what drugs they take.
Well, it doesn't matter. Nobody's sitting there and cataloging the medications. I've used Drug Take Back Day on a number of occasions. All you have to do is take those medications, put them in a brown paper bag, and go and drop them right into the receptacle.
Should you leave them in the container that you have them in so that they know what they're getting?
That really is not necessary. And if that makes somebody, if that's a decision somebody wants to make, certainly you can take them out of the containers and dispose of them that way. And it's perfect. There are absolutely no, it's not as if they're not going to take them if they're not in the original prescription bottle. And again, this also applies to over-the-counter medications. Anything that you don't need, don't want, and that's expired in your medicine cabinet, put it in a brown paper bag and take it and dispose of it. It's really, really simple.
A lot of people keep expired drugs on. They just want to use them up. They don't want to waste the money. What difference does it make?
Makes a huge difference. Over time, medications do degrade. They have an expiration date, just like the milk in your refrigerator. And you don't want to use medications after their expiration date. Medications can change over time. Their efficacy can basically be reduced to zero, or their effectiveness can change. And so you don't want to be taking a medication where it's not going to have an effect or could have a negative effect on you.
How do you know how much is being collected?
Well, the DEA has kept some statistics on that, as have some of the private the retail pharmacies that mm-hmm. have collected medications over the years. We have seen literally hundreds of tons tons of medications that have been turned in around the country since Take Back Day started. And when you think about the size, you think about how many pills it takes to add up to a ton. It really has been a pretty remarkable response. And we think that it really is, it's one of the most important things that every American family, every household can do to contribute to battling the opioid crisis. Because we know the data is clear. The misuse, the diversion of prescription opioids directly contributes to the opioid epidemic and to addiction. And it is something that everybody can do that is not just for the common good, it's really for the good of their family. And leading into the holidays, it's even more important because we know during the holidays we have large gatherings, we have extended family coming into our houses. Make them safer. Just be on the safe side and ensure that you've gone through and removed any temptation, any risk, and gotten those medications out of your house.
Douglas O'Brien, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Glad to be on. And we just want to remind everybody this Saturday, Take Back Day, all across the country, and take 5 minutes and make your house and make your community a little safer.
And you can find out where you can drop off those drugs. We'll have a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And we'll come back with more Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Doctors at Ohio State are using fitness level instead of age when deciding treatment for patients with cancer. We wanted to talk about why this distinction matters. Joining us is co-director of the Cancer and Aging Resiliency Clinic at the Arthur G. James Cancer Hospital at OSU, Dr. Ashley Roscoe. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What is the Cancer and Aging Resiliency Clinic? How long has it been around?
So the CARE Clinic is a multidisciplinary clinic designed for older adults with cancer. The clinic originally was instituted in 2016, where we focused just on older adults with blood cancer. And over the coming years, we've expanded the program to be able to allow older adults with any type of cancer at any point in their disease trajectory. So for a patient who is newly diagnosed with cancer, for a patient who's on observation, for a patient who is a cancer survivor. So the clinic is really designed for any older adult with any type of cancer at any point in their care course.
And the goal is to increase resiliency while limiting the patient's hospital stay, which is all good. You don't want people in the hospital who are fragile. Because that's where you can catch the worst things.
Yeah, no doubt. So the clinic, resiliency is an interesting term, right? And so the resiliency clinic or the CARE clinic is really aimed to be able to optimize health factors unique to aging. And so the clinic, when someone is diagnosed with cancer, as an oncologist, and I'm an oncologist, when I see patients in my clinic, we focus on specific things. We focus on their diagnosis, what it means to them, how their chemotherapy or surgery or radiation course is going to go, and then toxicities of that therapy and specific details related to their cancer. But there's a lot more to a person than just their cancer when it comes to overall health. And so this clinic was really designed as a multidisciplinary approach to health in the context of cancer. So within our team, we have a 7-member team that's all focused on one single day. So within that day, as an oncologist, I see them related to things unique to aging, such as geriatric syndromes like falls, depression, insomnia, or difficulty sleeping at night, and talk to them a little bit about how cancer has affected them in those ways. And then I have 6 other members of our team that also address other factors unique to aging. So we have a physical therapist, we have a nutritionist, We have a pharmacist. We have a case manager. We have a nurse who focuses on memory. And then we also have an audiologist to talk about sensory impairment. And this is all done in one clinic visit on one single day over about the course of 2 hours.
Sounds like a busy time.
It is a busy time. And we do it in a round robin fashion where the patient is central. They stay seated in the clinic, and then the physician comes and sees the patient, and then the nutritionist comes, and then the pharmacist comes.
So they're not running around like a chicken.
Exactly, which is what we do to patients on a regular basis, right? You know, we come to the physician, and then we identify a problem, and then we send them to the next person to go see. And that's a burden on the patient, and that's also a burden on the caregiver. And so what we've done is centralized that care and bundled it in a single visit. So the patient only has to go one place, and then the caregiver also only has to go one place too. And they're not traveling to seven, oftentimes, you know, it's six different buildings at, you know, different locations within campus. And we're able to centralize that care for the patient and be able to also communicate to one another. So as you can imagine, what the pharmacist may say or when they're reviewing the medications, it may affect what the next person in terms of nutrition, it could affect their appetite. And so we all work together to be able to identify what the problems are, the deficits are, and then to be able to put together a coordinated plan for the patient through the course of their cancer course.
When the protocol was just age-related, how did that differ from this?
Yeah, so this is very different. So, you know, as an oncologist and as a treating physician, we see many older adults within our clinic. That's a pretty common thing. And so within our clinic, though, we're, you know, focused more on their cancer-related care. We know that the age may play a role, but we really just eyeball it in the clinic. We're like, well, I think you look good. I think you're going to be healthy enough to tolerate an intensive treatment. But we have ways in the discipline of geriatrics to be able to both really quantify and identify how healthy or how fit a patient really is. But that requires another subset of, you know, testing and, you know, which is what we do within our clinic. So we're able to use that clinic to be able to augment and provide better oncology care for the patient because it's unique to that person and not their chronologic age, but their physiologic age when it comes to treatment decisions.
You know, when I was reading about this, the point was made that there are a lot of older people coming down the pike.
You bet.
They're coming at you right now. I mean, is this an efficiency?
Ohio is aging just like the rest of the nation when it comes to older adults as a whole. And so this clinic really affords the ability to do something that we don't do very well in oncology care. So part of it is an efficiency for us to be able to optimize those factors. But importantly, health and frailty, you know, is dynamic. So where a person begins may not be where they end when it comes to cancer care. So, for example, when someone is newly diagnosed with a cancer, patients can become very frail. They may lose weight. They may be sick related to their cancer. But with good treatment, patients can become better and stronger and healthier. And we have to be able to have ways to identify what those factors are and then intervene upon them throughout their cancer course.
Does this include deciding whether or not to treat at all?
Yes. Absolutely. And especially within the clinic, we often see patients in the concert of bone marrow transplant. So for patients who, in older adults, which is common for patients to undergo a bone marrow transplant specifically when it applies to blood cancers. Mm-hmm. And so we see many patients when it comes to a very intensive treatment like that to make sure that they're able to tolerate an intensive treatment. And so we do see many patients there, but the same concepts applies to patients whether or not they need to undergo a major surgery for their cancer care. And so we're able to do more rigorous assessment to identify whether or not they would be able to tolerate a more intensive treatment.
Or chemo or radiation. Exactly. Or any of these treatments.
Absolutely. Importantly, older adults with cancer are undertreated. And the clinic is really designed to be able to afford any older adult treatment opportunities and for us to be able to mitigate any deficits when it comes to age-related factors.
So if it's been concluded that treatment's not an option because it's not they're too frail, Are they then out of your clinic, or does your clinic still work with them?
We still work with those patients. And so importantly, it's an uncommon thing where patients, you know, really are unable to tolerate any treatment. We have cancer care as a whole has really grown and expanded where traditional chemotherapy is still used in many ways, but we've also advanced in many abilities to offer novel treatment, targeted treatment, where it kind of falls under that umbrella of chemotherapy. But we have many more treatments than you could imagine when it comes that are much better tolerated for older adults, pills, shots, for that older adults can tolerate very well. So importantly, the clinic is really meant to afford all patients the ability to get therapy for their cancer.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Dr. Ashley Roscoe. She's co-director of the Cancer and Aging Resiliency Clinic at the Arthur G. James Cancer Hospital at OSU. And we're talking about looking at a person's physical well-being instead of their age and determining treatments and how to take care of them and how to strengthen them for treatments or how to make them as comfortable and healthy as possible if they forego treatment. If you have a question or a comment about that, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I asked about the issue of continuing treatments because a lot of people we've heard from over the years and I've talked to over the years have said, I just wish we would have known when to stop treating, when we would have felt comfortable. And I'm wondering if you have those kinds of conversations too.
Absolutely. So in the clinic, we focus on, because I'm an oncologist and we have oncologists that are within the clinic, we're talking to patients from an oncology perspective. When it comes to a new diagnosis or survivorship or someone who's actively receiving chemotherapy throughout their course, one of our main questions is that cancer affects everyone's quality of life in some way. And so that's our very first introduction to the clinic is how has cancer impacted your life and from a quality of life perspective, how we're able to optimize those factors. What are the barriers? How can we overcome it? And does it make sense in terms of the toxicities of the therapy? Is there specific toxicities that have affected their quality of life? Specifically, what we commonly identify as neuropathy, which is numbness and tingling and the ability to move. And so we often can do dose adjustments to chemotherapy to be able to minimize those side effects. Fatigue is a major symptom that many of our patients are occurring. And so our patients ask us pretty commonly, you know, is this fatigue cancer related? Is this fatigue age related? Is this fatigue secondary to chemotherapy or radiation? And that's not an easy thing to always tell, but we can use this clinic to be able to measure where the fatigue is really coming from. Is it depression? Is it related to thyroid abnormalities that are from the chemotherapy? We have a physical therapist in our clinic that's able to measure lower extremity strength and walking and gait speed. And so we have a really much more intensive approach to be able to measure those age-related factors in the context of chemotherapy.
Measure them and treat them.
Measure them and treat them. And so for many patients, we can identify, you know, what we're really, you know, the fatigue is not really coming from, you know, when we test your low extremity strength, you know, you do have the strength, you do have that there, but we really, you know, find that it's related to the chemotherapy being intense and then relating to changes in their blood counts and they're tired from that. And so we put together programs, whether that's either exercise programs or speaking with their primary oncologist about minimizing certain parts of their chemotherapy to be able to allow them to have the quality of life that they're looking for.
You mentioned sensory issues. Are you talking about hearing?
So we have an audio.
because a lot of people go through this with older parents who don't have good hearing, is they're not good reporters and they just kind of nod away through an interview with a doctor and they don't really hear stuff.
Exactly. So sensory impairment is a big part of what we do in the clinic. And so there are in the clinic, the patients, you know, are seen by an audiologist in a sound booth. So we can get a real clear assessment of if there is a sense of neural hearing loss. And so the patients get an audiogram that we can get a better sense of what's happening, if it's symmetric, if it's asymmetrical, if they are candidates for hearing aids. If there is a specific deficit where patients sometimes have swelling behind the ear, and those are things that we can fix and we can address. And so we do a very specific, so we have a sound booth within the clinic. Our patients get an audiogram within the clinic so they can, so we have a better sense of what they're hearing, if there's hearing loss.
But you know that Medicare doesn't cover hearing. That can be extremely expensive. I was just talking to a friend of mine who spent thousands of dollars on a really state-of-the-art, fabulous hearing aids, and he loves them, but that's not necessarily an option for older people who have limited means.
Absolutely. So there's many of our patients are on a fixed income, and so we take that into account. But we also, for patients who are veterans, that we're able to connect them with the VA to be able to have access if they have hearing loss in our veterans, we're able to connect them to those programs. And also through Ohio State, if through the ENT clinic there, we if there are vouchers or waivers that we try to connect them there, especially for patients who are on a fixed income, that we try to make those connections. But there is some cost limitations, but it also making sure that we are connecting them with the VA if they're a veteran, because they're able to get hearing aids at free or no cost.
When you talk about ending treatment and making that decision and that you still will see people and you still, you know, want to be involved, or they can still be involved with the clinic, how does that play with hospice?
Yeah. So, you know, from our perspective, you know, we have this, you know, unique approach to being able to do this multidisciplinary assessment for patients who are either getting therapy or ongoing therapy. But importantly, if we are making transitions, or if we identify within the clinic that from a quality of life perspective, this is no longer a sustainable pathway for them, then we work very closely with our palliative care team. So we, you know, importantly, we make distinctions that we are not, you know, a palliative care end of life clinic. This is really for patients who are living with cancer and for wellness. But
and that's an increasing number of people that are living with cancer because of the treatment options available.
Absolutely. Yeah. So this is really about living with cancer. And as an older adult, many people are thriving and thriving in our clinic and are managing quite well and are very independent. And so the unique factor to aging is that we don't all age the same way. It's not necessarily because we get older that our health deteriorates or declines and we are all doing it on the same, you know, pathway. This clinic is really because aging is, there's so much heterogeneity with aging, where we do have patients who have cancer and who are not thriving and who are not doing well. And so we help transition them to a whole area, a whole discipline dedicated to best supportive care and end-of-life treatments. But our clinic is really about thriving and how we can identify and help those factors to be able to maintain independence while they're living with cancer as an older adult.
You mentioned memory as well, and memory assessment, and that's got to be a big issue. And a lot of what occurs, you know, in any kind of wellness situation, you know, a healthcare situation, is conversation. And there's not enough written down sometimes because people can't remember. If they can hear it, maybe they can't remember it very well.
Importantly, memory impairment is something that, as an oncologist, that plays a major role when it comes to outcomes. Patients who have memory impairments are sixfold higher likelihood of dying from their disease. But as an oncologist, we may, you know, check heart function, we may check kidney function, but we're not routinely assessing someone's underlying memory. And so within this clinic, this is we do testing for our patients, so we can do an assessment of their orientation, their short-term recall, their executive functioning or thinking, just how we think, and that clinic, and attention, importantly, attention. Chemotherapy affects attention in many different ways. And so we do an assessment for patients where we're able to address those factors, and then we relay that information both to the patient, the caregiver, to the primary treating team, and also their primary care physician. If we identify concerns based upon our testing or that the patient identifies concerns, then we can recommend more formal testing short of our screening tools. But for many patients, it's, you know, a pattern that we've identified before. So we oftentimes work with their primary care physician if a patient needs additional medicine.
And what about nutrition? I mean, what are you looking for there?
So nutrition plays a major role into cancer therapy as well as aging. And so we assess nutrition from many different facets. Weight loss, since we're able to identify what the percentage of weight loss is, their body mass index, whether or not there are chewing problems, swallowing problems, taste impairment, and we have methods where we're able to overcome that. Some of it's being able to identify their calories. Sometimes it's medicines that we need to introduce to stimulate an appetite, and some of it has to do with taste. A lot of our chemotherapies affect our ability to enjoy food, enjoy foods that they previously enjoyed, and how do you account for that when there's this other elephant in the room of having to undergo chemotherapy or other therapies that affect their ability to eat?
Is the clinic going to be participating in medical marijuana?
So the clinic specifically, Ohio State as a whole, is very much interested in looking at medical marijuana. And, you know, we're still sorting out how to navigate that in the clinic. But older adults routinely ask about cannabinoids when it comes to oils, when it comes to ingestion. And we are looking into that within the clinic as well.
It to become one of the because you have to be certified to prescribe or to recommend, I think, is the proper.
As a physician at Ohio State, yes, we will be, you know, following the guidelines that the institution lays out for us.
Another chronic problem a lot of older people have is oral health. And is that what you're talking about with chewing? Maybe their teeth are bad and they need help with that?
Yeah. So a lot of, you know, sometimes teeth are removed or extracted. And so they're, you know, not able to eat the foods that they have done before, or there's poor dentition to begin with. One of the things that you had brought up previously when it comes to, you know, fixed income is the ability to have dentures. And that's another cost
not covered,
which is a major barrier. So we talk about ways that that patients are able to maintain their calorie intake if they have to modify their diet. And so when we talk about supplements like Boost and what patients like and what we're able to in order to get the calories, because as you can imagine, when patients are rapidly losing weight or patients are continuing to lose weight, we need to find methods to be able to maintain that, because it's directly related to their endurance or stamina and the ability to walk and to be able to sustain that physical activity, which is a major barrier for many of our older adults.
How much are caregivers involved in all of this?
Very much, you know, so within the clinic, we encourage a caregiver to attend the clinic appointment. So we also have a case manager who meets with our patients and their caregivers. And the case manager, who is a nurse, whose primary focus of the clinic is to be able to identify needs that for the patient and also for the caregiver. Some of our older adults are caregivers for other people. And so when someone has been affected by cancer, it may change their role, where they were previously the primary caregiver for someone else, and now that they're the person that's been affected by cancer, it does change their role. We talked to them a little bit about how that's affected their ability to care for one another, because as you can imagine, that can significantly impact how they feel, how their ability to provide for other members of their family.
And a lot of times it's their partner.
Right, exactly. And so that's an important role. But then in other cases where there's caregivers that are helping the person who is an older adult, again, you know, identifying that there's so much heterogeneity when it comes to aging in that way. So we have a case manager who identifies things such as their ability to travel to and from the clinic, because we can help with this. Other services that are in the home when it comes to having additional support, needing home health care, needing home physical therapy, having a nurse that can come visit the patient to make sure medicines are correct. We assess that. We also work with agencies within the state of Ohio for patients who are not just local to Franklin County, but for outside agencies to be able to connect them with the resources that are available to them, both with a cancer diagnosis as an older adult.
Yeah, that's something when you do visit the James, you find that there's people from all over the place there. It's not just Franklin County.
Absolutely.
You've said that research into geriatric oncology is lacking. It's something that the clinic's working on too. What are you looking at? What are you studying?
So our group has been very fortunate that we have many physicians and research scientists that are very active and engaged in supporting cancer and aging research as its own discipline. Geriatric oncology is its own field where that we focus on the science of aging and also at the intersection of when someone has a cancer diagnosis and also the science behind as someone gets older. So we have several. We have clinical trials specifically designed for older adults, which is an unusual thing, as in many clinical trials are designed for younger individuals.
Right. And healthy.
People who are fit, but we realize that we need to target the people who are most affected with cancer. So we have many clinical trials designed specifically for older adults with cancer, including in that we have a recent assessment called a fitness assessment. We're really able to identify someone's health using a robust assessment of fitness using surveys and assessments that we do within the clinic. But in addition to that, we're looking at blood tests that mark physiologic age. Mm. So we work with our basic scientist, specifically Dr. Kristen Bird, who's very active in this field, for us to be able to identify factors related to aging using blood testing. So it's no longer this subjective, I think you look pretty well, mm-hmm. but more or less for us to be able to really mark and denote what aging means from even blood testing.
Dr. Ashley Roscoe, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
It's Dr. Ashley Roscoe. She's a researcher and co-director of the Cancer and Aging Resiliency Clinic at the Arthur G. James Cancer Hospital at Ohio State. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up. We're going to be talking about fitness, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. We gain about a pound or two every year starting in our 20s. And by the time most of us reach our 50s, we start to lose weight. But for too many, the lost weight is muscle. Author and science and fitness journalist with Outside Magazine, Alex Hutchinson, recently covered that issue. We'll post a link to it on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Alex Hutchinson joins us now by phone. Welcome back, Alex.
Thanks, Ann. It's good to be back.
You wrote about why we need better guidelines to deal with age-related muscle loss. Why do we lose weight as we age in the first place? Is it mostly due to that muscle loss?
Yeah, I mean, it can be a mix of things for different people. But mm-hmm. as time goes on, your appetite changes, but also the way your muscles respond to food changes. You're less, protein triggers muscle to form, but the older we get, the less we respond to that trigger. So we just, without realizing it, we start to lose weight, and unfortunately we lose the important weight, which is muscle.
Why are we losing the muscle? I say, because I'm sure I am. So why is it
happening?
Yeah, well,
I am too, and this is why I write about this issue, because it feels important to me. The truth is there's a lot of changes that go on just societally and socially. As we get older, we're less likely to be, out at the park playing pickup basketball or whatever the case may be. We get less active. But also, things are changing within our cells. And there's something called anabolic resistance, which just means that the stimulus, a combination of food and exercise, which triggers the growth of new muscle, we get a little bit resistant. So the same stimulus that would have kept us healthy and kept us growing muscle when we're 20, by the time you're 40, it's not working as well. And by the time you're 60, you need to eat more protein and certainly need to keep exercising just to get the same stimulus you were getting 20 years ago.
For a lot of people, I suppose that pops up with a lot of vegetarians and vegans, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we need to necessarily point fingers at specific diets. People who are eating vegetarian or vegan diets, hopefully they're very conscious of the need to get sufficient protein and to get different kinds of protein. And there is some evidence that vegetable proteins are a little bit less effective at triggering muscle growth than animal proteins. Now, that just means you have to eat a little bit more protein. So it's perfectly possible to be healthy and full of muscle on a vegetarian or vegan diet, but you really have to be aware of the issue for a starter. You have to realize that protein is important for muscle growth.
Does this pay homage then to the younger next year guys who said that as you age, you need to be exercising more?
Yeah. I mean, let's be cautious and realistic in our forecasts. We'd all be doing pretty well if we just exercised as much as we all did when we were 20 or 25. and so to do that for a lot of us who are older, it does translate into doing more than we're doing this year, maybe. But you don't have to be doing Ironman triathlons or participating in bodybuilding competitions to be healthy, but you need to just be getting out there every day, doing some activity and doing some full body activity. I'm a runner. I love running, but what I've realized is that running keeps my cardiovascular system healthy, but it's not going to keep muscle on my upper body, so that if I want to be able to push myself out of a chair in 20 years, I need to wake up and do some upper body exercise.
Are there guidelines that recommend what to do and what to eat?
There are. I mean, so I'm up in Canada, so I'm familiar with the Canadian guidelines. And the point that was raised in a recent editorial in a journal or a recent review in a journal is that these guidelines are a little bit old. So the most recent guidelines for protein intake, which are applied to both Canada and the U.S., came in 2005. And we have some exercise guidelines in Canada that were from 2011. And, I wouldn't say we have all the answers now, but we know more than we did in 2005. We understand more about how our needs change as we age. So it's not easy to change those guidelines, because when you're talking about government guidelines, it's a vast process with a lot of stakeholders and trying to agree on what the science actually says. As you know, and all of us who watch nutrition research know that you can't find two scientists who think the same thing. So changing the guidelines isn't easy, but it's needed, because the current guidelines don't really say a lot of – they focus more on aerobic exercise, which I think is great and important, but don't really give some specific guidelines about maintaining muscle. And they also don't really the protein recommendations are quite low. It's what you need to survive, not what you need to thrive.
What you need more than anything is sleep. And you also wrote about a new study that looked at how the time of exercise can affect sleep. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is one of those things that you hear lots of conventional wisdom about. If you work out at the wrong time, you'll screw up your circadian rhythms. This was a study that came out of the University of New England where they decided to test that, and they had a group of people work out either in the morning or in the afternoon or not at all. And then they tested their melatonin levels. Now, melatonin is a substance in the body that kind of tells your body when it's time to go to sleep. Around bedtime, when the sun goes down, your melatonin levels start to rise, and that triggers various changes, makes you more sleepy. It also makes your body cool down, which is a sign that you should fall asleep. And some people take melatonin to help them sleep, but you can look at the body's natural levels and get a sense of how sleepy you are. And basically the short version of the story is that people who exercised in the afternoon, I think that was about 4 in the afternoon or 5 in the afternoon, 4 in the afternoon, they had lower melatonin levels at 10 o'clock in the evening and then also at 3 a.m., which makes them a little bit less likely to fall asleep. So it kind of supports this traditional wisdom that if you work out in the evening, you may have trouble falling asleep. But I guess the one thing I would like that I think it's important to remember is that melatonin is just one small part of getting to sleep well. And it may be that your evening workout is the thing that allows you to unwind at the end of the day and get all the negative work stress out of your mind. And so maybe it's really important for you to get to sleep. But it's just something to consider if you are having trouble sleeping and you're used to going out for a run at 9 at night, maybe that's a factor that's sort of preventing you from getting to sleep or even staying asleep once you've gotten to sleep.
What about what you do for a workout? Does that play a role? Say you do some kind of yoga versus go for that run.
Yeah, my assumption is that yes, it would definitely play a role. This study didn't look at that, but there's a huge difference between going and playing Beater League basketball at 10 o'clock, which is what I do on Friday nights, and it's probably not good for my sleep patterns, or doing something that's more meditative, more relaxing, doing a yoga session, or even going for a a relaxing run or something. And I think it depends on the person what you find really pumps you up versus what relaxes you. So I think this is one of those pieces of information that's useful to stow away and say, this is something to keep in mind. But it's not something to say, therefore, I must change my habits. You know, if you're doing okay, I wouldn't mess with your routine. But if you are having trouble sleeping, then you might consider maybe it's the timing of my exercise. Maybe a 5 p.m. workout is not helping me sleep.
Well, I would say, you know, I used to work out religiously in the early morning, and it just started to really conflict with my morning schedule at work. You know, it was I just learned that I really need to be focusing on my job. And I'm wondering, for a lot of people, how much that dictates things, not whether or not they get a good night's sleep.
Yeah, for sure. You know, over the years, I've written about a lot of studies about work, when to work out, because there's other factors like circadian rhythms. Your body temperature rises and falls, so that actually your peak performance might be better at 6 p.m. because your core temperature is a degree higher. Mm. And the overall conclusion that I take from all this research about the subtleties of workout timing is that you should work out whenever it's convenient and fits into your day. And because for most of us, the number one thing is it's important to get some exercise in. And we all have different work constraints. We all have different circadian rhythms. Some of us like to stay up late. Some of us like to get up early. Some of us can do either. And so you need to find a time that works for you and is convenient for you. And the benefits of finding a convenient time to work out far outweigh the sort of 2% faster because you find the optimum time. Mm. Unless you're having, you know, serious problems sleeping or something like that, that's when this kind of thing is like, okay, maybe I need to rearrange my day. But for the most part, I'm totally with you. I think you have to find what works in your day that allows you to be happy and productive and not, you know, dragging yourself out of bed 2 hours earlier than you want to.
And you looked into heat therapy. You wrote about how heat therapy is being used by athletes around the world. What is heat therapy?
Yeah, heat therapy is a lot of different things, but athletes are using it to try and get faster or fitter. And, doctors are using it to try and potentially reduce cardiovascular risk. It's this whole, I don't want to call it a fad because there's a lot of science behind it, but there's a real upswell of interest in the use of heat. The simplest example of the kind of heat that people are using is saunas. There's all these studies in Finland now where people still take saunas all the time. And they've been doing studies for 20 or 30 years where they had, you know, look at how often people take saunas and then said, let's watch them for 20 or 30 years and see who does best. And now those results are coming out, and it's like the people who take the most saunas have the lowest risk of all sorts of different conditions, whether it's, cardiovascular disease, Alzheimer's, and happiness is something to consider too. The mm-hmm. Finns are always at the top of the World Happiness Index. So there's a realization that heat can trigger, it's like a stress. It's a stress on your body, and in response, your body adapts in ways that can be really helpful. You can increase the volume of plasma in your blood, so your blood plasma volume. You can change when you sweat, you're more efficient at sweating, and it can even change the properties of your arteries, makes them a little bit more subtle. So it's not like a miracle cure, but it may have some pretty profound effects both for athletes and for people just trying to be healthy.
A lot of people do heat in conjunction with another kind of shock to their system, which is cold. You know, we used to, when I was a kid, we used to, you know, jump in the pool and then go into the sauna kind of a thing. What about that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that's a lot of fun.
But?
I think in terms of getting the full benefits that we're talking about here, in terms of stressing your body with the heat, mm-hmm. You're kind of going to be counteracting it if you then roll in the snow for a little while and then jump back in the hot tub, because you're going to prevent your core temperature from getting high enough. Now, it may be that if let's say you've got a really hot sauna or hot tub, and then you just kind of plunge in the cold pool for a second just to make sure that you're not getting out of control, and then go back in the sauna, maybe that's going to work out. But I think I would classify that as pleasure rather than, you know, therapy.
Okay, Alex Hutchinson, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thanks very much, Anne. I enjoy chatting.
Alex Hutchinson, he's author, science and fitness journalist with Outside Magazine. He's also author of the book Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.